Welcome to episode 299 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. Advanced geothermal has come of age. Over the past year, there's been a noticeable uptick in news stories about it, and governments everywhere seem to be keen to support it with a variety of policy tools, including subsidies. Everywhere except Canada. Which is strange because Calgary is home to Ever Technologies, one of the world's leading advanced geothermal companies. Listeners can search the geothermal list on the Energy Media's YouTube channel to find interviews and videos that explain how Ever's unique technology works. Today, I'm joined by Ever's CEO, John Redfern, to get an update on where his company is at and the role it might play in Canadian power grids as the country doubles or triples electricity generation by 2050. So welcome to the interview, John.
It's good to be back. I'm missing it.
Well, indeed. And we've missed having you. I did about a year or so ago, I interviewed your business development manager, Paul Cairns, about Ever and what you've been up to. And since then, you've launched the project, your first commercial project in Germany, and it's in Germany, south of Munich.
Right.
I think that's a great place to start. And I should mention before we get into that, we're not going to spend a lot of time, listeners, explaining Ever's technology because we have all of that on the website and on the YouTube channel. You can go there for that. I would strongly advise you to do that because it's good background. But the thing that I want to start with is that German project. And maybe you can just give us an overview and an update on it, John.
Certainly. Thanks for the intro. The German project, yes, it is our first commercial project. It's been a long time coming, though. We've done a couple of demonstration projects or pilot plants. First one in Rocky Mountain House. It's all started in Canada, and as well down in New Mexico and more volcanic terrain. But that was to prove up the technology. But of course, if it's something new like we have and is radically different, people say, show it to me. I got to see it. I got to feel it. And, you know, we could see that in the past from even our Rocky Mountain House project. Even so, it was the middle of COVID and everything else. We had 1,000 different people plus travel up from around the world, investors and other types, just to go and put their hand on that hot pipe and hear feel the heat being pumped up from underground without a pump. Just it's hydro thermosiphon. But now this is what we have is something different. A true commercial project in Germany. One of the challenges of clean tech in general is it's incredibly capital intensive. You know, this thing is no different. We're talking about 350 million euros plus just for one project, but it's going to be the demo of all demos. Right now, for the last year or so, we've had two of the largest rigs in Europe, you know, with 58-meter high towers, both there side by side, drilling simultaneously, and they're not going to stop drilling till 2026. And by that time, they will have done some 300 and some kilometers of wellbore. So they're going to get a lot of practice. So that's going to take a while. And in the meantime, we're almost finished constructing a power plant, an ORC system, in between the two drilling wells. So people will be able to come there in the center of Europe, see this project being built, see it already producing power, getting ready to heat the local town, but also see future loops still being constructed there. So it'll be the ideal demo center.
As I recall, your system, which is basically a big radiator underground, doesn't require a pump as it draws heat from the surrounding rock, heats up the water inside of the fluid inside the pipes. It's like a big, it expands and it comes out the other end. It's very, very
water naturally rises and we piggyback on that. So
it does indeed. And it produces both hot water for district heating and to turn into electricity, correct?
Yes, it does. It's going to do both. When it's a winter and they need maximum heating potential, will this all be direct heat use? In the summer, we've got excess capacity, so we'll turn it into power. Going forward, projects will more likely be heating first and then power later, or just direct heating all in one spot. But we wanted to demo both at the same time. But of course, you know, both those markets are red hot right now. The heating market, because of the Ukrainian situation, there is no alternative. And the heat market in Europe is as big as the power market. But also the electricity side, having scalable electricity, it's almost not even, they want it to be green. But the main problem right now is this electricity demand is anticipated to shoot up. When we started, it was all about the energy transition. And then it started, you know, it was also about filling in behind wind and solar, which were intermittent, that we were solid. Then it became all about how EVs were going to up electricity demand. But the big elephant in the room right now that's come out of nowhere is AI. And AI has got all the hyperscalers, data center owners scrambling for where they're going to get their power. And, you know, we're right in the crosshairs. We've really had a lot of, I'd like to say it's all our technology, but it's also market timing and being in the right place at the right time.
I am going next week down to Pincher Creek, which you will be familiar with, down in southwest Alberta, mm-hmm. in the Crow's Nest Pass. And they want, we're going to be holding a lunch and learn and a little workshop around the energy transition and how they can use the abundant, clean, low-cost electricity that comes from all of the wind turbines in that part of the world to attract industry, and data centers are at the forefront of that because they also have a very good data back or telecom backbone, which are the two things you need for in that industry. And one of the issues that's come up in discussion already is the role that a technology like Evers might play as a firming technology, a dispatchable electricity technology that could be deployed in that area and would work very well with the intermittent wind. And given where we're going with data centers, how quickly we're electrifying transportation with buildings probably not far behind, actually, with heat pumps now catching on.
Yeah.
This combination of intermittent renewables with your technology seems like a home run. It's just a no-brainer. Am I correct in that?
You are correct. Yes, a sommelier would say we pair nicely with wind and solar. That was the whole start of our journey. Was, you know, one of the things that got us going was the advance in drilling technology, but the other was this market that was created by the success of wind and solar. They've done a lot of what they can do, and they're peaking out in some markets, like in California, where they got all the solar they can use. But they got solar after dark is what they need, and that's what we represent. We're that infill for that 4 o'clock to 10 o'clock time period when everyone's maxed out and the sun's going down.
There is a big contingent of supporters for nuclear in Canada. And Canada, does have the CANDU technology, and it's very popular in Ontario. And in fact, 17% of Canadian electricity is nuclear. But whenever that topic comes up, I always advance ever as an alternative. Say, why would you go with nuclear, which is, you know, famous for budget overruns and scheduling overruns, and has waste problems? And I mean, it's not the perfect generation technology by any stretch. Why not take a technology that's based in Canada, comes out of the oil sands, all of the drilling techniques that you use and so on, were pioneered in the oil sand. This is a uniquely Canadian company. Why are we not coming to the fore, both the provincial governments and the federal government, to support the scale up that you need to really truly commercialize Evers technology and drive down the cost, which is what happens when you scale up? Any thoughts on that, John?
A whole bunch of thoughts. Part of it is we have been getting some support, and that's been coming fast and furious. I'll talk about that in the meantime. But on the nuclear issue, my first degree is engineering physics. I was originally, when I left school, was considering a job at Atomic Energy Canada or Ontario Hydro, as it was known at that time. And, you know, I'm as convinced as anyone that technically nuclear can be made to work. But it's got such a political handicap and all this other, you know, time delays and everything else, what the mini resurgence of nuclear tells me is there is an unmet market need, for firm, you know, low carbon power. And they're suggesting nuclear because they think there is no other alternative. Exactly. You got to be desperate. So it proves up our market in our case, but it is the one low carbon source that's higher energy density than us, but it's got too many drawbacks, especially politically. It's a big advertisement for us. So
I know you're going to get into the government support or the support, and just before you do, I want to say that there's an issue here around timelines, because, you know, for instance, there are many people want to go with small modular reactors, an unproven technology at this point.
It's small.
It's small. It's cute.
Pocket size. Yeah.
You can put it in your back pocket. Wonderful. But one of the major advantages that Ever brings to the table, as far as I can see, just as, you know, as a outsider, is the ability to go from project conception to project completion very quickly. We're not talking about years and years and years and years of planning and capital investment and so on. You can get rigs on the ground and start drilling and produce electricity and hot water fairly quickly. Am I correct?
Fairly quickly, but to be, you know, totally fair, both nuclear and traditional geothermal take a long time to get set up. What we do is we're definitely faster than nuclear, and we're definitely faster than traditional geothermal, because traditional geothermal involves that entire sort of exploration game, which it can be long as, you know, who knows how long it can be, but it adds several years and all permitting, everything else. And you got to finish all that and defining the resource, do the delineation drilling, before you can even order the work system or the power system, which takes time to come. You will notice in my description of our German project, our power plants, you know, almost finished, and we've just started drilling. That's because, you know, the unique thing about our geothermal, unlike other geothermal, is we know what it's going to produce ahead of time, and we know what it's going to produce for the next 20 years. And that makes it financeable, makes it faster to scale up.
What you're looking for underground is not pools of hot water, basins of hot water. It's hot rock, and hot rock is everywhere.
Absolutely, especially, you know, the deeper you go, the more uniform the earth looks. It's all hot granite if you go deep enough.
Right, and which means that you could basically put an Ever system pretty much anywhere.
Pretty much anywhere, but to go back to what I was saying earlier, we want to pick the low-hanging fruit first. So, you know, because it is capital intensive, and we want to run down that learning curve with commercial projects, not having to invest too much. So we'll eventually be able to go anywhere, everywhere. But for the moment, we want to, you know, pick our spots carefully so that we can, you know, get as far down the learning curve as possible and lower that cost of electricity, levelized cost of electricity.
If I remember correctly, the German government is providing a feed-in tariff of 251 euros per megawatt hour of electricity.
Right.
Plus, you receive 96 million euros from an EU innovation fund. Have I got those numbers correct?
90.6 million euros.
Oh, sorry. 90.6.
Yeah. No. So, and what you didn't mention is the heat price, which is set more by the market, is even more profitable than that power price you just told me. Because when you consider the conversion between heat to power in an ORC system, it's in the teens. So that's, and you have the cost, extra cost of the ORC unit. So if you can sell heat, like we're talking about, to 50 to 90 euros per megawatt hour, that's fabulously, you know, profitable compared to electricity even. But you have there's basically three things that drive the economics. Cost of drilling. A place like Canada is great. It's probably the cheapest place on the planet to drill. Two is the temperature gradient. The higher, the better. Canada's not so hot on that. And then three is, what is the offtake price? And again, we're blessed with a lot of our own natural gas and stuff like that. So power prices are pretty competitive in Alberta. So much better to go to someplace like, let's say, Japan. got infinite demand, has to get rid of coal and nuclear, has to import all of their energy needs. They want to be energy independent. They've got a super high geothermal gradient because they're on the Pacific Ring of Fire. And you look at all that, but it is an expensive place to drill. But you got to factor all these in as to where you start, and it's also dependent a bit on where we've got good partners as well who are ready to drill. Do you want to go back to that Canadian support?
Yes, please.
Because I want to make sure hand out the kudos where deserved. And again, we started with a bunch of angel investors, people like Doug Beach and that, and Ross McCurdy and a number of others in Calgary. That got us, a fair bit of the way. But to build the original pilot plant in Alberta, we needed the support of Alberta Innovates, Emissions Reduction Alberta, NRCan, Sustainable Development Technology Canada Limited. So those four institutions collectively basically paid for that first pilot. So we're indebted to them, and people like Precision Drilling donated the rigs at the time that they had some excess rigs, and that really helped. But other than that, we've got no support. I don't know, maybe it's just one of these, we're local, so we don't get the same. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I know a prophet has to leave their town in order to get any recognition. The old saying.
But the government did come back in a couple of forms, and one was the Canada Growth Fund that allowed us to, remain independent and turn down some other offers for our company, and they've been tremendously helpful, and I know we're working on some other stuff with the Alberta government, who are also been very helpful, and I think we're going to have an announcement on April 30th of something of interest.
Excellent.
I can't tell you what, so.
That's okay. I'll be around on the 30th, and maybe I'll attend the press conference. Look, John, let's talk about the support and the process of getting a new technology off the bench, out into the field. It generally goes from the lab, then into some kind of a demonstration project, then into a pilot project. Then it's got to be moved into its first commercial project, and then it begins the process of scaling. And costs as you do that, costs come down. And there has been barrels of ink spilled on the problem in Canada of the Valley of Death.
Well, it's not just Canada. There's valleys like that in every country, but
it is a particular problem in Canada. We've lost how many technology companies to the United States because they come in, snap up the company, take it down south. Carbon Engineering, which started in Calgary, went to Squamish, now has got bought up by Texas-based Occidental Petroleum, and that's where the technology is going to be scaled up.
Right.
That's an example. And how does Canada, when I say we, I mean Canada, avoid that problem with ever?
Well, we went through that same ladder of success of development you talked about, except we maybe cut out the first couple of rungs because most of the technology we had, the building blocks we had, were high TRL stuff already, as proven in the oil industry, and just repurposed. We're working on some lower TRL stuff now, but the commercial project is based on rearranging a bunch of things like magnetic ranging and insulated drill pipe, some of which we've invented, some of which we borrowed. But that got us off to a rousing start. And, the trick, if there has been any trick for us to survive, is to be a Canadian company. All our design work and R&D and everything's done here. All the high-level stuff is done here, which is what, by the way, we should focus on more than just the projects. Everyone wants to say, where's the local project? No. Where is the local head office that has all the white-collar jobs and all the well-paid jobs that will continue our prosperity into the future? But to get there, we definitely had to leave town, so to speak, not physically, but we had to cast our net farther afield. And we were a little bit lucky. I mean, I spent the previous 13 years in Asia, and some of the other people were you know, like our head of origination, Robert Winslow, came from Europe. So it was easy for us to go and check outside sources of funding. So we got our VC funding from Singapore. We got our, you know, our strategic investors from the UK, from Austria, from Japan, places like that. And you just got to go where the people will recognize it. And you can't just try at home. They're all global markets and we're competing against other people. You have to know what's happening in those other markets anyways. So my one bit of advice would be, don't give up, but cast a net wide. Because if we hadn't, we'd be nowhere. Because like I say, none of the local VCs in Canada, none of the local strategics in Canada invested in us. Other than Precision, who did a small thing at the start.
Right. I know the last couple of press releases on your website they concern the Department of Energy down in the United States, which, of course, mm-hmm. over the last couple of years has committed, well in excess of $1 trillion to clean energy technology over the course of right. the next decade. So the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure Act, there's other things like Defense Department spending. It's a big effort for the U.S. to catch up to China for a whole bunch of reasons. And right. there's been a lot of concern in Canada that companies like yours are just going to follow that the IRA draft, you know, right down into right. the U.S. and then they'll be lost to Canada. What's your take on that?
My take on it is twofold. One, I think the U.S. government isn't doing everything they should, because for Canada and U.S., this is the one clean energy technology we can still dominate. It's the one where we lead in. Wind is gone. Solar is gone. The whole vertical value chain is elsewhere. So they should be, you know, pushing us as much as they can. And yeah, they've contributed a fair bit of money down in the States to geothermal, but it's a fraction of what they've spent on everything else. It's one-tenth or less of what they spent on nuclear, of all things, which we were just talking about. So the U.S. has to, it's not that Canada has to step up to match the U.S. The U.S. and Canada both should be pushing this technology a lot farther, because it's the ultimate energy solution, and it's based on what we do here. And that's what people often miss in startups, is that you can't just have a good idea. You have to have an idea that you're uniquely positioned to exploit and develop, such as we are here, because no one knows more about drilling holes in the ground than Canada and the US. But if I started it somewhere else and didn't have that expertise, it wasn't going to go somewhere. So we have to look at where we have strengths and build on those. And as well, when you go back to the US thing, you got to remember that they themselves were just trying to catch up with the incentives in Europe. So, and I can tell you the feed-in tariff in Japan is even higher than Europe. So I think it's a global thing. It's not just a US sucking all the talent out from Canada. There's a competition for this talent, because more and more people are recognizing there's some high ground to be captured here in the early days. And it's happening in Asia, happening in Europe, happening in North America. We, you know, we got most of our funding from Europe and Asia, actually.
So but, given that as background, John, look 2 to 5 years down the road, maybe even 10 years, if you like, and tell me where you want ever to be. Where do you think it's going to end up? What does the future look like for you?
Well, we want our future. We want to be a tech company, and we want to be in a position to leverage all the other major, you know, oil companies or service companies or construction companies. And because we've got a bit of an intellectual, you know, an IP moat around our solution, we don't have to build all these ever loops ourselves. Thank God. We're 150 people. You know, we do one loop a decade and then it'd be the end of it. I'm exaggerating a bit, but the idea is to take partners we have, like BP or like OMV. People like OMV, they're, you know, you don't hear a lot about them over in here in North America, but they're the largest company in Austria, a substantial oil producer, and they're totally committed to building Everloops. They've got billions of dollars set aside, and a whole bunch of expertise to do that in the German market, you know, the Hungarian market, the Romanian market. They're all big potential markets. And we've got similar people lined up like Chubu in Japan and BP. And the idea is to, our job is to deliver the licensing and the tools and the supplies and everything to allow other people to drill thousands of these things, to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. And that's how we change the world.
So your business model is not to drill the holes necessarily, but to perfect the process and continue to innovate in that space, and then right. license the technology with your partners.
That's correct. But part of the way in the early days we developed that IP is A, working with the partners, but B, actually implementing these things and sure. going first in a lot of the first of the kind areas or technologies, and also building. Sometimes some of our partners want to own the asset, like Chubu, let's say, who's an electricity company, but they don't know a lot about the subsurface yet, and so they'll want us to still do that part of it. So we do what we have to, but the idea is to get Everloops in the ground and to get an entire ecosystem around what we're doing to support that. And that's what's exciting for Alberta. Yes, we're going to have some Canadian projects that we're working on, and those will eventually come on stream. But the really exciting thing is we got a whole ecosystem of suppliers in that have been developing their technology alongside ours, and it becomes a huge export potential. You look at someone like Gunnar, who's working with us on the magnetic ranging. They're going to go all around the world with that, I'm sure, alongside our Everloops, which is their biggest use case.
What about, okay, so if I've heard it said, not in the context of Ever, but in the context of other geothermal companies, mm-hmm. that at the reason why advanced geothermal might scale pretty quickly is because there are big drilling companies who are looking around for potentially very profitable business models that they can scale. Because if you're talking right. about, I mean, all precision drilling is big in Canada, but by global standards, it's not that big.
Right.
But it is a bigger player here. And companies like that could look at that and go, hey, you know what? This is a market we can get into. It's our expertise. We know what we can partner with Ever. And right. this can be our little patch that we develop. But you can do the same thing down in Texas, over in California, over in Europe, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So are the drilling companies, the oil and gas drilling companies, a natural fit for you to rapidly scale up the technology and the application of your, I guess, move into new markets?
Our success, the more successful we are, the more it's an opportunity for drilling companies, not just to use up some of their existing rigs and personnel, but also to design entire new rigs that are sort of fine-tuned to do what we're doing, because there's some differences. But the nice thing is, just think of our German project. It's, you know, 3 or 4 years of drilling in one place for two rigs outside of Munich. That's it's a different lifestyle for the rig workers, first of all, but it's a different demand on the rig development. You can amortize the entire cost of the rig just across one project. So you shouldn't be constrained on what's available in that pool. But the thing we always got to remember, to be realistic, is that if we're going to displace any significant proportion of the oil industry's demand, we have to be a similar scale. So you got to think of the size of the oil industry, the number of the rigs, the number of people, the number of resources that go into that. We're not going to be like magic and be able to do that without that. So we're very lucky. I view it as an opportunity. We're very lucky that we have an existing industry at scale that I don't like to use the word, but it's the appropriate word, that we can cannibalize for people, machinery and everything else. And that's the way that we're going to be able to scale quickly.
There's an argument made by Kingsmill Bond of Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado, who is going to be right. joining us next week for a webinar, And I've interviewed Kingsmill many times, and part of his argument for why the clean energy will scale up as quick, much quicker than people think, is because the migration of capital from oil and gas will move into projects like yours and scale them up. So the access to capital, in his view, ultimately will not be the issue because it'll be moved from one industry to another. And that sounds like you kind of are maybe thinking along the same
lines. I agree, but I disagree. I agree that there's going to be a transfer of capital. But what do we look like to a banker? We don't look like an oil and gas play. Traditional geothermal does. It's, you know, an exploration game. People go in there and they're looking for a resource. And once they find a resource, then they develop it. We're actually, for a banker, look more like wind and solar. We're predictable output. We've locked in all the revenue from the start. And, you know, it's got very, very little risk and lots of predictability. So I think it's going to be people who are maxed out on wind and solar. Tons of money have gone into that. It's been commoditized. The margins have gone down. A lot of jurisdictions have too much of it already and want something firm. So I think it's actually a lot of revenue. If we're successful, the people, the tools, and the skills will all come from the oil industry. But I think the capital will actually shift from other renewables or other. There's no lack of money in the world, but, you know, the fact that we can offer a fixed return and low risk and it's green all at the same time means that the one thing we won't have a problem with is money.
Isn't that interesting? The financing of green technologies is one of the issues that comes up over and over again at international gatherings where you have people like Mark Carney talking, and they say, right, yes, there's lots of, you know, capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to go. They just haven't got the projects. And well, here we've got a project that is perfect.
They've been waiting to go. It's lining up to be first in line to go fifth, we always say, right? And this is exactly the same situation. Garrett Sreed is no huge money spinner, right? It's a single digit return. It's there to prove it out, but it's the subsequent ones are going to have that nice double digit low risk return with lots of scalability. It's not one here, one there. You can just start and you just keep developing it more and more. That's what's going to attract the avalanche of capital. And there's no shortage of that. But what does still take time is this, you know, getting, if you're going to do something in Japan, for example, getting the rigs to Japan, or just getting, you know, it takes a couple of years to get through all the permitting and everything else. And it's taken us a few years to get this demo that, you know, we'll be able to prove that we can do it at scale.
But I think that's fascinating that you think your opinion is that the capital is going to come from jurisdictions where they've maxed out wind and solar, but still have to decarbonize their grids and scale it up. And they're looking for firm dispatchable power. And your Ever is a very unique solution to that problem.
Yeah. If you're just starting to go green, of course you attack the low hanging fruit there, which is get rid of coal, do things like that, put a bunch of windmills and solar panels in, the interruptions of which can be mitigated by the grid itself. But then you get the grid overwhelmed and you need to, you know, eventually have something firm, and people decide they want to go all green and not just natural gas, or they decide the natural gas from, say, Russia maybe isn't as secure as they thought, so they still want to go green. But for an energy independence point of view, these are all driving this decision. So I'm not saying there's not going to be oil and gas investors who go into geothermal, because traditional geothermal is like that. It's the same risk profile as oil and gas. But I'm saying for ours, if we're going to truly massively scale it, it'll be like wind and solar.
You brought up something at the beginning of the interview that I want to pursue, and that is the industrial heat market. Because and in Germany in particular, which is the industrial powerhouse of Europe, the Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been a real problem. It spiked natural gas prices, which is where they get most of their industrial heat from. And the sector has been really struggling. So there's been a lot of failures. It's a big policy issue. And it seems like ever with its ability to produce industrial heat at reasonable costs is a, if it's not the solution, it's a big part of a potential solution. And so what are folks in Germany telling you about that?
Well, that's not the first area of deployment, because often industrial heat use, you want very high temperatures, which we're not particularly good at, but we're perfect for district heating, and we're perfect for preheating stuff for other things. And when we produce electricity, there's lots of ways to produce ultra high temperatures with some of these new startups who are looking into storage via thermal storage. But it's not the most efficient thing. So, you know, we've got an almost infinite market just displacing district heating and electricity production. Other stuff, it could come later, because again, where are we evolving? We're evolving to go hotter and deeper. That's the longer term trend for any geothermal. Hotter, deeper, faster, cheaper with better drilling technologies. And then when you get those higher temperatures, you can encroach a bit more into the industrial heat market. But right now it's not a big priority. Oh, okay. But there are, you know, there's lots of industrial uses that aren't ultra high temperature, which we're still useful for. You know, like big mines, they often need some heat, but they need a lot of electricity base load. But of course, you know what the real driver is of demand right now that's really turbocharging our market. It's, you know, it originally was just going green. Then it was the fear, you know, the electrification of everything, EVs and everything else, was going to drive the need for more green power. Now it's all AI. In the last year, out of nowhere, you look at the hyperscalers' plans for, you know, putting in more data centers. It has just gone through the roof. And especially in places like Japan or Singapore, that where they want to put a lot in and they have no local power, it's not even a question of being green anymore. It's just a question of, you know, do they have the power to enable their growth plans?
Given the fact that Eber can be, I'm assuming this, but that your wells can be drilled fairly close to the source of demand.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you, I mean, I'm sure you can connect to the grid. That would be perfectly fine. But is it also possible where you have data centers and other sources of high demand, like maybe it's industrial or commercial, that you can be part of a microgrid, or you can be self-generation for a large operation? What about those applications?
No. I mean, I think they often want to be in with the grid, but they don't need to be. Because again, we're firm, and they're not like a lot of other things we need to be in the grid. All they need is a data connection to the outside world. So we could place it almost anywhere. It could be self-contained. I mean, the other place we can put it to get around grid interconnectivity problems is you can put Everloops under a whole bunch of wind farms or solar panels. You know, by definition, the solar farm is only using that link 30% of its total capacity. We can put a Everloop under that and produce around the solar peak in the middle of the day and turn it into base load without any new capacity or power lines being built at all. So that's sort of a midway point. But yeah, you could definitely go behind the fence. And that's what the Defense Innovation Unit at Department of Defense is looking for. They want to know ways to make their, you know, their sites independent of any outside, you know, need for outside energy, gas delivery or electricity delivery or any connection to the outside world.
Yeah, so, given the fact that it's so expensive and so difficult to build new transmission capacity, to upgrade existing distribution capacity, all of those are very difficult political, permitting, technology, technical issues, and so on.
The fact is, NIMBYism, you know, the whole NIMBY side is when you have power going through your backyard for someone else. If you're just producing locally, as we do, I mean, most people don't object to that, especially if it's all buried underground as well, too. And they drill plenty of these things in the middle of cities in Europe and stuff like that. So yeah, then really reduces the need for power lines all crisscrossing the country, and you know, making some huge investments in a smart grid just so we can plug in more windmills doesn't make much sense. Windmills and wind and solar makes lots of sense when you're starting out, but they eventually reach a saturation point when it becomes sensible to look at some of the other alternatives, not just us, but other people.
Sure. No, I get it. We're seeing, you mentioned California earlier in the interview, and we're seeing that kind of debate take place already.
Yeah.
You know, and what they should do about it, what their options are. And you can see that other jurisdictions that are downstream of that, you know, Texas is right on California's heels. Mm-hmm. And then some of the other American states are rapidly moving in that direction. And we'll see that play out in outside of North America. So that makes perfect sense. And it's the you know, I interview a lot of experts who on power grids and electricity systems, who their big point, their big takeaway is that, look, we're in a period of intense technological change and innovation. Yeah. There's already a ton of new technologies that need to be integrated into the grid, like power electronics and digital controls and grid enhancing technologies and on and on and on. But one of the things we can count on is that there will be new innovations in the very near future that were under off the radar at the moment. And right. It could be ever, it could be whatever it could be, but we're going to solve some of these problems. We'll have growing pains. It's not going to be easy, and we're going to have to spend some money, but right. These are all solvable problems. And I like the way you put it, where, you know, wind and solar come in, they clean up the grid some, but there are limitations. Then you bring in a firmer source of power, like ever.
Or some data storage or power storage off peak. Yeah. Batteries get cheaper. It's lots of different things to do.
Exactly, exactly right. And every grid, every jurisdiction needs a different set of solutions that makes sense for it. And I can see ever being a big player in a lot of those solutions. Well, look, John, this has been fascinating. Always enjoy chatting with you. I'm going to wish you the best of luck for the future of Everett. We're going to stay in a little closer touch this time, because I'm fascinated by what's going on with your company, and we'll look forward to future conversations.
I will do the same, and we appreciate the interest. Thank you very much.